Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Today's guest grew up in Chico and is a proud alumnus of Notre Dame School and Chico High. Robert P. Baird studied mechanical engineering and human biology at Stanford and completed a master's degree and a PhD at the University of Chicago Divinity School. He has worked as an editor at The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, The Paris Review, and Esquire. Robert P. Baird has published journalism, essays, and reviews in a variety of outlets. In 2019, he published a long feature on the campfire in GQ magazine. He has now written his first novel, The Nimbus. Bobby Baird will be at the Chico Barnes & Noble on Wednesday, June 21st, starting at noon. Bobby Baird, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, the title, The Nimbus, is that a familiar term, do you think, for people? Do you think you need to explain what a nimbus is?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I think it's probably not familiar to most people. It's actually a term that's used a lot in art history. And what it refers to is the halo of light that you often see in religious art. In Christian art, we often see that as a halo around the head. But a nimbus can also cover a person's whole body, or it can look like tiny flames coming off their body. There's a whole range of ways in which artists have used it over the centuries. And one of the things that I was sort of interested in is that it shows up in a lot of different cultures. It's not that there's one source of this idea that was the origin for all of them. It seems to be that it kind of, you know, showed up independently across many different times and places.
Interesting you should say that, because I lived a year in Peru, and there's a main square with a statue, and there's the instructions to the artist, the sculptor, was to put a flame on the top of the statue's head. The word in Spanish for flame is llama, L-L-A-M-A. And so they get the statue back, and there's a llama, the animal, because it's Peru, and there's an animal on top of the statue's head. So you mentioned that this flame, well, that's the word in Spanish, llama, people are aware of this throughout a lot of cultures, this glow, which is why they use the word flame. So this is what you wrote a book about, and why would you choose? I mean, you had a degree in engineering, and you write about what gave you the idea to write this book, Bobby?
Well, yeah, so The Nimbus is a story. Basically, the story kicks off when this 2-year-old toddler starts to glow mysteriously. And it's not in the form of like a big tongue of fire or something like that. It's a very subtle glow. But it happens for a couple of hours at a time. Not everybody can see it, including the toddler's mother. But the toddler's father is a professor of religious studies, and he can see it. So can his graduate student, who's another character in the book named Paul. And, you know, I was interested in writing about religion. I was interested in writing about the role of religion in the world today. And I wanted to see if I could do that without reference to any specific faith tradition. In religious studies, which, as you mentioned, I spent a lot of time working on a PhD, you know, there's this kind of this idea that we can't talk about religion in the abstract, that you always need to be talking about a specific faith tradition, be it Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism or Hinduism or whatever. But I thought it would be kind of interesting and frankly kind of fun to see if I could try to talk about religion in a way that was a little bit divorced from any kind of particular tradition, so that people might not come to it with pre-existing ideas about what was happening in the book.
My guest is Robert P. Baird, and he has written a novel, The Nimbus. And it is a novel, but there's a place in your book where one of the characters says something about crossing and recrossing the boundaries between fact and fiction, biography and fantasy. Now, you went to divinity school, and so you have a character here who's a professor. So that part, I'm thinking, okay, now there's biography, but oh, so much of this is fantasy. So would you say that's true of your book, that you cross the boundaries between fact and fiction?
I would definitely insist that my book is not autobiographical in the sense that I have never met any glowing children. So that part is all fantasy. Also, all of the characters are fictional. It's not that I based anybody in the book on somebody who I know in real life. But, you know, there are probably obviously a lot of aspects of the book that I do draw on from life. A lot of the settings are not exactly like the divinity school that I went to, but they resemble them in significant respects. And I think people who spent time in or around that divinity school will recognize some of those aspects. For me, writing fiction is really a bit of a magpie affair. You kind of pull stuff from all parts of your life. And so in that sense, it's inevitably autobiographical, but it's not the sense that this is a covert memoir that I just kind of dressed up as a novel.
Well, the preface of your book is told in the first person. And it says, to the reader. And we thought, okay, if it's first person, then it must be you, Bobby. Are you the speaker?
this is part of the book. Do you want me to read some of that?
Yeah, yeah.
Should I read that? All right, I'll go for it. This is the part that opens the book. And the section is called To the Reader. It may help to know that in a lot of old religious texts, this was often a section that you would see the author would sort of write a little letter, as it were, to their audience. All right. When I was in college a long time ago, I enrolled in a survey course in the history of religion. My professor was an austere and grumpy ex-Lutheran, a historian of Christianity, who held his subject in roughly the same regard that an oncologist looks upon cancer. He was a Nietzschean, this professor, which meant that he was, in his own mind anyway, a realist of the most uncompromising variety. Like his intellectual hero, he was the sort of person who took both pride and pleasure in shredding what he saw as the comforting illusions that kept his fellow human beings from seeing the world as it truly exists. The professor began our class, as he began all his classes, by announcing that every story starts with a lie, the lie that it's possible to start somewhere. To admit the appearance of something new under our very old sun, he declared, suggested not merely a lack of intellectual rigor, but also a cast of character that he despised above all others, sentimentality. He believed, no, he insisted, that a clear view of religion required a clear view of history. And anyone who wanted to understand history had to dispense with any hope of finding meaning therein. Contingency, blind and bloody contingency, was the only iron law of history, he argued. Thus it followed logically that true beginnings, meaningful beginnings, of the sort that religions like to claim for themselves, were impossible. They were, in short, a category error, a deception of the most fundamental kind. Even Tolstoy, a Christian, knew this to be true. There is and can be no beginning to any event, the great Russian wrote in War and Peace, for one event flows without any break in continuity from another. Every story starts with a lie. If I can't help but recall my professor's mantra, please do not imagine that I thereby endorse his bleak philosophy of history. But since you'll have every reason to distrust what follows, I still hardly believe half of it myself. Let me confess here at the outset that I have taken certain liberties with the truth. Though I have tried to accurately record the most unbelievable of the events that I witnessed, I have changed some names and scrambled some personal characteristics in recounting their context. To protect the innocent, yes, but also to protect myself, who am far from innocent.
This is Robert P. Baird. He's reading from his debut novel, The Nimbus. And he was reading in the first person, but this was his character. And so you introduce us then in the first chapter to this character. So I thought that was a very interesting way to start, saying that true beginnings were impossible. And yet, we have to begin your book now. So would you read us the beginning of your actual story, Bobby?
Sure. So this is chapter one, where we first hear about the Nimbus. He was on fire. Adrian's son was on fire. That, at any rate, was what it looked like the first time Paul Harkin saw, well, the first time he saw whatever it was. Luca Bennett, a burly, bubbly 2-year-old with gray eyes that drooped a little in the corners and a rumpled haystack of yellow hair atop his oversized head, was sleeping soundlessly in a jogger stroller in the corner of his father's office, and he looked like he was on fire. It was not a big fire, to be sure, not a bright fire, certainly not a blaze or conflagration. More like the flame you see on the underside of a broiler, something low and close. At once lucent and translucent, it traced Luca's baby fat contours in 3 dimensions and extended a 1/2 inch or so into space, dissolving into wispy filaments that rustled according to a rhythm that appeared impervious to the motion of the air around them. To Paul, that first time, the light appeared deep yellow. Later, others would say that they saw it as blue or pink or even clear, like the fumes from an open gas tank. One woman compared it to the radiant fuzz that clings to the outer edge of a lit neon tube. A college sophomore said that it reminded him of a dense and luminous fog, of the sort that settles onto a city after a rain in the lamplit dead of night. A little girl said the glow looked like the stuff that seeped out when you popped a firefly open between the nails of your thumb and forefinger, while her mother said she was put in mind of the blue blur of atmosphere you see in photos of Earth taken from space. A man who'd lost his eyesight 30 years earlier in a boiler explosion swore up and down that he could see Luca in a sort of reverse silhouette as he moved. The boy's entire tiny being, the man said, appeared to pulse, flare, and churn in tempestuous whirls like the movies he remembered watching that showed the roiling surface of the sun. Around the Divinity School, where Luca's father, Adrian Bennett, was an associate professor, and Paul was that lowliest of human entities, a graduate student, there was much debate about what to call it. This was hardly surprising. The faculty included experts on all 5 of the world's major faith traditions, as well as scholars fluent in another dozen or so minor religions besides. There were more than a handful of professors and doctoral students at the Div School, in fact, who could speak eloquently, extemporaneously, and at considerable length on the visible charismata of the Gnostic pneumatics, the dazzling, variegated splendors of the Buddhist saints, Apollo's glistering halo at Hadrumetum, the glamours of the Sumerian Malam, the uncreated light of the Neoplatonic hierarchies, the swirling aureoli of the Tibetan Tangkas, the mysteries of the divine Kavod, and the gold leaf almonds and fish bladders that enveloped the holy fools in medieval Christian manuscripts. They knew their archons from their arhats, their saints from their zadiks, their wali from their kami. Being scholars of religion, they also, of course, knew their share of charlatans, cons, and infamous frauds. The golden plates buried on a hill in upstate New York, the mass hallucinations in Medjugorje, and the collective pareidolia that saw Hanuman in a mahogany tree in Singapore.
This is the opening chapter of The Nimbus, written by Robert P. Baird. He goes by Bobby because he went to school here in Chico. Also notice, Bobby, that you showed that you were from the area because the way you said almonds.
Yeah, I grew up, exactly. I grew up in the middle of the, what we still call the almond orchards. My kids make fun of me for it. I tell them that the elf falls off the tree when the nuts get shaken off the tree.
Well, so we meet this professor, Adrian, and you mention this lowly graduate student whose name is Paul. And a little later on in the book, you tell us what Paul thinks of the Divinity School. Would you skip on over to reading that the Divinity School is obsolete, and why is religion persisting? And I think a lot of people wonder about this. Here we are in the 21st century, and religion is still persistent. So would you read us that section of what Paul thinks about it?
Sure thing. Within the university, the Div School was often seen by other disciplines, including in the humanities, as obsolete. You could study dinosaurs in the English department, or reality television in Comp Lit, and no one would bat an eye. You could even study religion, so long as you understood it as epiphenomenal, something that needed the fundamental theories of psychoanalysis, or Marxism, or economics, or anthropology to be comprehensible to the modern mind. But religion, as at least half the Div School's faculty and students tended to approach it, religion as a constructive enterprise and a going concern, was something else entirely. Over the years, Paul had assembled a clever-sounding rationale to deflect the barbs and befuddlement that came his way. To his mind, there was no great mystery why religion persisted in a modern world that professed to have no need for the supernatural. Forget what the rigorists would tell you, that the most important question for any religion was who was in and who was out, what it took to be counted good or bad, which beliefs or practices or prayers would make you a saint or a heretic. Forget, too, any thought that the universe stood ready to reveal its deepest mysteries if only we could ask our questions in just the right way. Paul felt strongly that people would always want a mental box to hold their hopes and fears and desires about the muddle of existence. They would always seek out some way to address questions to their confusion that they could formulate in no other manner. You could call that ultimate concern if you wanted, or the feeling of absolute dependence, or you could just call it religion. Of course, it was true that the answers people found in religion were often terrible, chief among them the answer that said the demands of heaven overruled any ordinary claims of human solidarity. That was how you got Isaac on the rock. That was how you got the Crusades. That was how you got burning witches and kamikaze monks and pedophile-protecting churches. Yet the bad answers were also in their way, beside the point. As long as there was longing, there would be disappointment. As long as there was love, there would be heartbreak. As long as there was life, there would be death. And as long as there were any of those things, Paul believed, religious feeling would always be able to find itself a foothold. For these reasons, Paul let himself say, in his more pretentious moments, religion was the specter that haunted modernity, the wraith in the rafters that was as embarrassing as it was unevictable. You could try to leave it behind. You could try to use science or philosophy or ideology critique to make a clean break on unhallowed ground, but you couldn't escape it. Maybe Nietzsche was right. Maybe God is dead. But this is not tantamount to saying that God was gone. He was truly the Holy Ghost.
This is Robert P. Baird reading from his debut novel, The Nimbus. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Robert P. Baird, and he has written the novel, The Nimbus. Now, Paul is a graduate student, and he's at some point wondering why he chose religious studies. So do you mind telling us why you chose religious studies?
Sure. Yeah. My reasons for choosing religious studies in divinity school had nothing to do with Paul's. I had one of these experiences in colleges that you could almost type up and put in a brochure for aspiring students.
Was this when you were at Stanford, you mean?
Yeah, when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, I had a couple of really terrific professors who taught religious studies. I was interested in religion personally. I grew up Catholic. As you said, I went to Notre Dame School. So I had kind of a longstanding personal interest. I kind of thought I'd take the class just to see what it was about. And, you know, I had no experience with the academic study of religion. But between the religious studies courses I took and a couple of classes I took on Dante, I really got super interested in this as a field of study. And it kind of occurred to me for the first time in a way it hadn't before, that this might be the direction I'd like to take my life. As you also mentioned, I originally came in thinking I was going to study engineering, and I loved a lot of aspects of that. But I realized that this kind of intersection of literature and religion was where my real passion lay. So that's what I decided to do after I graduated.
Now, you mentioned that this Adrian can see the nimbus, can see this glow, and Paul can see the glow, but the mother cannot. And you tell us she's an atheist. So I think that might be kind of a relief to people who are saying, oh, now, Bobby, this stuff is just too far out there. I can't go along with this. So have you had any reaction of people thinking this is really pretty far out that you're writing about?
Not so far, but, you know, the book is just about to come out, so we'll see how people feel when more people get their hands on it. You know, I think a lot of people who have read it focus on it as a novel appropriately. But I think if we think around in our lives, it's not too hard to think of people we might know who have had really profound experiences that are important to them, but that maybe they can't articulate or share with even some of the people closest to them. I don't think that that's such a strange thing for most of us. That experience might be religious, but it could also be something else. You know, people spend time in wars, for instance, and that's a really hard kind of experience to communicate. People have all kinds of experiences that I think we find difficult to share. And so that's some of what I was trying to get at. I didn't want to make it something that everybody had instant access to. And Renata, the mother of the glowing boy, really has to kind of figure out how to deal with this through the experiences of other people. She has to deal with it secondhand. And that's really one of her central challenges in the book.
So we've mentioned Adrian, the professor, Paul, the graduate student, the child that glows, Luca, he has a brother, Max. You've told us these characters, but then a little farther on, we meet this character. We thought, now, what does he have to do with this story? And his name is Warren. And how did Adrian know this guy named Warren?
Right. So Warren is a librarian. And as you mentioned, when the book starts, he might seem kind of out of left field because he doesn't have any direct contact with Luca, the glowing boy. As you also mentioned, he does know Adrian, but they know each other only glancingly. They overlapped at the Divinity School. Warren was also an alumnus of the Divinity School, as Adrian was. When they were both in graduate school, they overlapped, but they didn't know each other well. And so they actually run into each other after Warren has an accident. He runs into Adrian kind of accidentally, and he happens to see Luca. And sees him glowing. And that's the event that brings him into the story.
Well, there's a section, too, when Warren talks about time, and his father said that there's no such thing as time. There's no substance to time. So who was Warren's father?
So Warren's father is a doctor who was born and grew up in Uganda, and he escaped Uganda and came to the United States and worked as a doctor in Chicago. And he was also a hard-going atheist. But he sent Warren to a Catholic high school in Chicago, and that kind of got Warren interested in religion in ways that didn't entirely make his father happy. But when Warren was a young boy, he had this kind of strange experience where when he'd be laying in his bed late at night, he would sometimes feel like he could actually feel the passage of time flow past him, almost as if it were a breeze. And he kind of looked around for a while and tried to figure out if other people felt this too. He asked people some oblique questions about it. And when he finally decided to ask his father and see if this was something that happened to him, and his father said, no, absolutely not. So I'll read a little passage here where his father's kind of setting him to rights. There was no substance to time, Warren's father said, no equivalent to the molecules of air in a breeze or the photons that made up a sunbeam. Time was like temperature. Time was like heat, a useful abstraction, but nothing substantial in itself. The analogy went way over Warren's young head, confusing him several times over. But in a way, it didn't matter. Warren was just getting old enough to suppose, shocking thought, that his father was not the impregnable bastion of omniscience he'd always seemed. Maybe he didn't feel time flowing. Fine. That didn't mean Warren didn't. In high school, Warren learned that his father was not alone in his misapprehensions. For his 17th birthday, his uncle Mike, his mom's oddball kid brother, gave him a book as a gift. The book was an airport bestseller about contemporary physics, and one of its chapters was about the unreality of time. Not time in general, not time tout court. The book allowed that a certain understanding of time, time as a dimension, time as a variable, time as a vector of entropy, was real enough. Time could be theorized as a component of a strange dimple fabric called space-time. It could be counted and calculated, and could even be measured after a fashion with clocks. But time as we experience it, time as the ever-cresting wave of a present tense that slides inexorably from one moment to the next, time as the great wheel that rolls us relentlessly through our days. That, the book said, is nothing but a psychological illusion. Time is nothing that moves or passes or flows. All change is static, and what we perceive as motion is in truth as fixed as the individual frames of a film strip. This was all old hat. McTaggart and Einstein had made the same points decades earlier. Warren knew that now, as he hadn't known it then. Back then, the book's odd ideas about time had confused and astonished him, just as the thought of a Warrenless world had confused and astonished him when he was younger. This is how time got its hooks in Warren. This is how time set its trap. It would be too much to say that Warren's temporal agitations were entirely responsible for sending him careening toward the catastrophe that awaited him at the divinity school. But they certainly played a part. In an elective course he took his senior year of college, not long after he got himself baptized as a Catholic, he was assigned Augustine's Confessions. He'd read the book before, during his junior year of high school, but the first time around, it had succeeded only in making him feel bad about how little sexual experience he'd had by comparison with Christianity's most venerated saint. On his second reading, however, Warren couldn't fail to notice Augustine's famous meditation on time, or that the author of the introduction to his edition appeared similarly harassed by the obsession that was still haunting him. That author, he read on the back cover, was a professor of theology at the university's divinity school named Eric Webb. On a whim, Warren wrote him a letter, an actual letter, on paper and everything. He said something about how crazy he'd felt for the questions he had. and how lonely. How was no one else bothered by this? He wondered. 2 months later, Professor Webb responded with a 6-page letter of his own. Mr. Kaita, it began, I can't speak to what happens outside the Divinity School, but let me assure you, we are bothered here.
This is my guest, Robert P. Baird, reading from his novel, The Nimbus. And Bobby went to Catholic school here when he grew up in Chico and graduated Chico High and went on to study what you might expect when he went to Stanford. But then he decided he wanted to get a master's and a PhD at a divinity school in Chicago. So this, what you know about divinity school apparently comes through in your book because that's where they are. That's the setting of this book, right? Chicago.
Correct. Yep. Yep. Yeah.
So we meet this character named Warren, and he is just saying that he's been, actually he says time had tricked Warren in one statement. So I don't want to say too much about Warren because your story is actually kind of a mystery, Bobby. And so in mysteries, we don't want to give away the surprises that come along when we're reading this mystery. But some of the things that you include, I find fascinating. For example, I never thought about the origin of the word dictionary, and it was invented. I mean, we know Shakespeare invented a lot of words, but who invented the word dictionary? This was a long time ago.
This was a long time ago, yeah. It was actually a scholar at the University of Paris named John of Garland, who wrote a number of works, but one of them was called the Dictionarius. It's a Latin form of dictionary, and he's the first person to use a form of that word, as far as we know. The book he wrote was not a dictionary in the way that we know it, where there's kind of headwords in bold with dictionaries that follow it. But it was almost what you might think of as like a learning manual for first-year Latin students. And the reason why he made this book is because students at the University of Paris at the time, this was in the Middle Ages, were required to speak Latin at all times, including when they were not in class. And a lot of them, you know, came from all over the place. They might not know Latin that well. We think of Latin as being a very popular language in the Middle Ages, but it was really the language of learning, and everybody had their mother tongue that they spoke much more naturally. And so this is a little book, and it kind of told a story where John himself is a character in the narrative, and he walks you through his house and tells you what the names of all the things in his house are. He shows you his closet, and he shows you his table, and then he heads out into town and introduces you to all the shopkeepers, and eventually he has a kind of a vision of heaven and hell and describes some of that stuff. But it was really, you know, it's this like fun little book that I came across during my studies that I always kept in the back of my head, and I realized that when I was writing this book, I might be able to work it in, and I was pleased I was able to do that.
Well, there's also a point where Adrian now is Professor Paul, and he says, I don't care about Latin or any of the other languages. We'll work that out. The point is, I want you to make yourself an expert on human incandescence. Now, I was also thinking about your dissertation, because he's saying what he wants Paul to write this brilliant dissertation. And you wrote your dissertation on Dante. So I'm wondering,
that's correct.
You must have studied Latin, did you?
I did, yeah.
And what about Italian?
Yep.
That's what I thought, because the very first words in your book, the very first page is in Italian, you quoting Dante in your book. So you had interesting reasons for the things that you did. And at some point, you must have contemplated this question that comes up with the wife, Renata. And about the boundaries of fact and fiction. But now you mentioned something I thought was interesting, Epicurean trilemma. And what is the Epicurean trilemma, Bobby?
So this is something that comes up in one of the Warren sections. I should say that the book is kind of told from three perspectives. It's told from Paul's perspective, from Renata's perspective, and from Warren's perspective. So each of them gets a chapter, and then we start back again with Paul. So this comes up in one of Warren's chapters. And basically what's described sometimes as the Epicurean trilemma is this problem that that kind of everybody in theology, certainly in Christian theology, but in lots of theological traditions, has had to face, which is that if you have the idea of a God who is all powerful and who is also all good, then why do we have suffering and evil in the universe? So it's called a trilemma because you can kind of think of it as three points of the triangle. God is all powerful, God is all good, and yet there is suffering in the universe. And so, you know, if you know anything about religious history, you know that there's lots of answers to this problem. And it's one of the central questions that people have tried to confront in theology down the centuries. Warren sort of stumbles across this idea that a guy named Soame Jenyns, who's a real person, lived in the 18th century, a British member of Parliament, came up with. And it's this kind of funny idea. Jenyns basically suggested that, well, we don't have any trouble thinking about the fact that animals suffer for our own happiness. So we eat, most of us eat animal flesh. We use their hides for leather. And that gives us pleasure. So what if it was the case that human suffering was meant to sort of benefit a higher order of creatures, be it angels or otherwise? And Warren has had a pretty unhappy life in many respects. And so he sort of toys with this idea to help help him think about the suffering that he's experienced in his own life at one point in the novel.
After a break, Bobby Baird and I will be back to continue our conversation about his novel, The Nimbus. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Robert P. Baird, who has written the novel, The Nimbus. He tells a story, and you mentioned like three different viewpoints. And at one point, Warren, this guy whose dad was from Uganda, says that his stint at divinity school, it cured him of Christianity for good. And here he goes to spend all this time in this school, and he says that the divinity school cured him of Christianity for good. Now, did you have other students there when you were there that thought, you know, I don't think this is for me?
Yeah, I think that happens a lot. I mean, one of the things that we spent a lot of time on in my actual divinity studies was learning about history. And, you know, I think there's a lot of ways in which people think that the main sort of challenge to religion and to religious belief these days is science. But I think historically it has actually been learning about history that has challenged a lot of people's religious belief. And so I definitely saw that in divinity school, where people would come in with a certain set of beliefs about Christianity or one of the other faiths. And then you really start to get into the history of what happened, and you learn about how, you know, may have been how some of these religious texts were written, about how they came together. It may have been about particular events. And that can, for many people, be a real challenge to their faith.
Well, we came up before that the wife, Renata, and the mother of Luca is an atheist. So how did an atheist fall in love with Adrian? How did that happen?
Well, I can actually read you a little section on that if you'd like.
Yes, please.
All right. Renata had fallen in love with Adrian over email during the course of a long-distance correspondence that started after they'd spent an evening together and then spent the night together at a wedding of mutual friends. She'd been flattered by his easy charm, impressed by the obscurity of his interests, and drawn to the warm fluency of his conversations. He was likable but not cloying, funny but not obnoxious, at once sincere and ironic in an ex-Gen X sort of way. A decade older than she was, he knew a lot about a lot and obviously loved learning, but he wasn't a jerk about it. He wasn't uptight. Not much seemed to get under his skin. Renata liked his looks, too, which answered a primordial fantasy involving beaches and lifeguards that she'd carried around since she was a girl. She also liked it when he had sworn early on, unprompted and with evident honesty, that she was the most beautiful woman he'd ever dated. But what had really taken her, intimidated her really, albeit in an intensely attractive way, was the depth of feeling and intensity of resolve she found waiting under his veneer of SoCal disaffection. Though she felt very old at the time, Renata was not yet 30 when she and Adrian started trading long emails after their wedding rendezvous. He was nearing 40, and was working as an adjunct in Ohio with no visible prospect for improvement. No one wanted to hire him. No one wanted to publish him. Even his first lucky break, which would come when a senior scholar at Indiana University happened upon his dissertation and invited him to apply for a tenure-track job, was still hiding up ahead in the unseeable future. Yet none of these setbacks had defeated Adrian's ironclad self-assurance. At Harvard, Renata had known plenty of would-be future presidents, corporate titans, and Pulitzer Prize winners, all of them as exasperating as they were confident they were headed for world historical renown. Adrian shared their sense of a grand personal destiny, but in him it was both complicated and intensified by the belief that he'd nearly missed his chance. He was certain that he'd wasted a precious bolus of time in his 20s, certain too that the soulless debasements of late imperial America had conspired to keep him from discovering his vocation in religious studies until it was almost too late. In his own half-ironic telling, by the time he started his PhD at the ripe old age of 29, he was as desperate for redemption as any sinner in the hands of an angry God. Feeling herself substantially adrift, in the doldrums of post-collegiate life, Renata had felt an immediate attraction to Adrian's purpose and drive. She admired the way he never let his feelings of belatedness get him down, the way he used them, in fact, as a spur to his ambitions. Most of all, she was impressed and not a little envious, that he seemed to know exactly what he wanted to achieve and exactly what he needed to do to achieve it.
This is my guest, Robert P. Baird, reading from his debut novel, The Nimbus. And we hear about how they met, and then they get married, and they have two small children. And how did they adjust to that, Bobby?
Yeah, I mean, you know, theirs is what I think of as a kind of modern sort of marriage, where I think Adrian, in theory, would like to be a good husband and a good father. He'd like to help out around the house. But theirs is also not a marriage in which the division of household labor is 50-50. It's maybe 70-30, with Renata doing most of it, or edging towards 60-40. And so what we get in some of the book is, you know, Adrian wrestling with the reality of trying to actually be a useful husband around the house. This little section I can read is just a paragraph, but it's about kind of how both of them felt about the experience of having young kids in the house. This is Renata thinking out loud to herself. Why had no one told them it was going to be like this? Why had no one warned them that they were going to be giving up not only the ability to go to a movie on a rainy weeknight or to fool around on a lazy Sunday morning, but whole swaths of what they'd taken to be ordinary existence. They'd been interesting people once, they reminded each other. Interesting people with interesting friends and fascinations and hobbies. They'd listened to new music and read old books. They'd thrown parties. They'd gone dancing. They'd enjoyed the fizzy delights of spontaneous conversation and the deep pleasures of solitary thought. They'd believed and had reason to believe that it was possible not to be tired. And now they had nothing, nothing but their boys.
And these are the thoughts of one of the characters in Robert P. Baird's book, The Nimbus. And this is Renata that we're hearing how she feels about being a parent. Now, these characters, the story continues and we find out what's happening to these characters, but I want to leave that for the reader because there are surprises built into this story. And I want people to be able to discover those for themselves, Bobby. So thank you for any parting words you want to leave us with?
No, I mean, the only thing I'll say is, you know, we've talked about a lot about some of the headier aspects of the book, but I don't want people to think this is like, this is itself some kind of dissertation. It is a real story. A lot of things happen in the book. And so, you know, hopefully you'll find it a page turner or something close to one.
Well, in the atmosphere of academia, Chico's a university town, and we have graduate students and professors. So this is kind of familiar territory for people who I think might be your readers, Bobby.
I hope so.
Well, thank you for being a guest today. And I'll tell people again, the title of your book, The Nimbus, and the author is Robert P. Baird. Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to talk to you.
Bobby Baird will be at the Chico Barnes & Noble on Saturday, June 21st, starting at noon. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Oklahoma, Here I Come, my first play. My mom and I went to see a performance of the play Oklahoma. The Orpheum Theater lights dimmed. People shushed each other and adjusted in their seats, the curtain raised. Oh, what a beautiful morning was played by an orchestra that I couldn't see. On stage, walls transformed into fields of wheat and weather vanes beneath a brilliant blue Oklahoma sky. I noticed things like that. I glanced at the rolled-up program I held in my hand, and on the front was a smiling Judd Fry, looking nothing like the menacing villain that he was supposed to be. Next to him was Curly McLean, his adversary. Both were smiling. Cowboys didn't smile. I noticed things like that. Lee Van Cleef never smiled. His face was a stone, was frozen in anger. Google him to see. I noticed things like that. I sighed at the start of each musical piece. I dreaded hearing the piano as it struck a C sharp, preparing for the next song and dance. A song and dance every 8.5 minutes was brutal for a 9-year-old kid. My type of cowboys never sang or danced. Lee Van Cleef never smiled. And hardly did Clint Eastwood. I noticed things like that. No horses, no wagon dust, no steel wheels, no sign of a Western here at all. My mom applauded happily at the final curtain when they collided at the center stage. She loved it because she knew what to expect. I was happy for her. And then it happened. They were back. More music. Thunderous applause greeted each actor as they reappeared from behind the closed curtain, smiling and happy. I gave in. It wasn't real. It was a play. My first. One actor waved his cowboy hat to recognize the balcony. Cheers erupted from above. All the actors on stage took a single collective bow as they lined up alongside each other, hands clasped, all down, then up. Perfectly in sync. Did they rehearse that too? I've been to many plays since, and most were great. I knew what to expect. But at 9, I wasn't expecting music and dance. That night, all I could hear over and over in my head were the words, Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain. I was asked if I wanted to see another play called Damn Yankees. I knew about Mantle, Maris, and Yogi Berra. Even at 9, I knew my Yankees. I wonder how they could ever play baseball on a stage. I just had to see that. I just had to. Sure, Mom. Sign me up. Mark Mallinger.
Song to be sung when the instruments falter. So he sat down and wrote a poem about egrets, and how they reminded him of thoughts too pure for us, too pregnant with the awful dignity of disaster. And then he took the egrets out, and he walked around with that image weighing him down like a sack of wet grain in his stomach, so that he swayed like a man who was slightly drunk, who was remembering, perhaps, or perhaps simply forgetting to forget the early days of some love affair or other, making slow sculptural gestures as an actor would, but an actor with no audience, a gladiator in an empty arena, waiting as the echoes of the jeers and applause of thousands ascend like newly freed souls and evaporate into the empty void that sheaths the planet. Left outside, exposed to the elements, anger will not be transformed into love, but the cord-like green tendrils that sprout out of it will linger for a while in the heavy and darkening evening air, like voices just on the other side of an open door, the way they carry in the evening, out over the flat surface water of a lake. And your name is someone else's name, someone you were forced to abandon, someone you knew once and loved. Troy Jollymore.
Wolf, OR 93. It was hunger, not the lust I imagined, or the wasted no-shame howl you sang. Your leg shattered on the side of the road, a cemetery, a ghost sorrowing through grass in winter. I read about you on the news, wondered how to calculate lonely. What level would you be besides the highest? Not hunger, not love, I am still measuring the word. Ivy Liebenberg.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.